Thank you very much indeed for that generous introduction. I would like to claim credit for the provocative nature of the titles of my books, but unfortunately it's almost always the publishers who come up with them. I propose certain worthy, but to be honest, turgid titles for my books, and they say to me, if you actually want to sell any, why not have this title? I want to begin by saying thank you, first of all. Thank you for a generous welcome. This is my first time in Australia, and I have felt very welcomed, and you've all been extremely generous and hospitable, even to the extent of putting on a day of drizzle and grey skies yesterday so that I felt at home. I'm touched. Steven Pinker, the world-renowned Harvard-based cognitive psychologist, ruined my Valentine's Day this year. It wasn't that I had a particularly romantic evening planned, although that would have been nice. It was rather that, having drafted the text of this lecture, I received a call asking me to debate with him about his latest book, Enlightenment Now: The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. I agreed. He was coming over in a week, and I needed to read his 450-page tome in advance. I started that evening, and I didn't have to get very far before I realised that Pinker was arguing precisely the opposite of what I had intended to say tonight. In essence, the world has made enormous progress on a vast range of measures in the last 200 years, and all of it is on account of the Enlightenment. More precisely, it is on account of the Enlightenment's reason, science, and humanism. More precisely still, it is on account of the Enlightenment's reason, as opposed to faith, its science, which has disproved religion, and its humanism, which is apparently incompatible with religious ethics. As I read the book, I came to realise that not only was I in for an interesting debate, but I'd have to rewrite my lecture. The American humorist P.J. O'Rourke once remarked that the idea that there was some golden age of pleasure and plenty to which you would, if you were able to transport yourself, could be disproved by one word: dentistry. Professor Pinker's argument is, in effect, a 450-page riff on this joke, as he demonstrates in forensic detail how we have made astonishing material progress over the last 200 years. Despite, I think it's fair to say, and my colleagues would almost certainly agree, that I'm a temperamentally glass half full person, I was impressed by and persuaded by much of what he had to say. However, we parted company on the question of why. As it turned out, the debate was in the end quite productive, perhaps in part because we were talking in the studio of a Christian media company and that he was speaking to someone who helps run a Christian think tank. I suspect he was expecting me to open with something like, "We need to give thanks to God for all this progress," or perhaps, "You just need Jesus in your life, Stephen." So when I began by referencing the Statute of Monopolies, I don't think he knew quite what to say. My argument then, which I hope to unpack a bit more tonight, is this. Of course, reason, science, and humanism are important to who we are today and how we progress. But the way in which Pinker defines them and leaves them vaguely rooted in something called the Enlightenment is deeply misleading. It's just not good enough to claim, as Pinker does, that the brain children of the Enlightenment were, I quote, free speech, non-violence, cooperation, cosmopolitanism, human rights, and an acknowledgement of human fallibility. Or that peace and mutually beneficial cooperation and voluntary exchange were Enlightenment ideals. Or, insanely, that the institutions of modernity include schools, hospitals, and charities. The idea that human cooperation, natural rights, and international peace were undreamt of before 1750 is just not tenable. And schools, hospitals, and charities are hardly institutions of modernity. In other words, Steven Pinker's enlightenment, and I fear the enlightenment of many of today's enlightened thinkers, is a bit of a caricature, a creation of the divinity of human reason, ex nihilo, in which the only threat of a fall comes from the irrationality of religion. More damning than this criticism, however, and the reason for my mention of the Statute of Monopolies, is the fact that the inclusive institutions that enable individuals and societies to flourish and progress almost all originate, in theory and in reality, before the Enlightenment. What do I mean by this? Well, it's important to begin by saying that there is no consensus about what enables individuals and societies to navigate towards freedom, prosperity, and peace. That noted, however, over recent years, historians and political scientists have honed in on what they call inclusive institutions. Over and against their opposite, extractive institutions, inclusive institutions allow and encourage participation by a great mass of people in political and economic activities that make the best use of their talents and skills and that enable individuals to make the choices they wish. Extractive institutions are pretty much the opposite. What kind of things are we talking about here? Well, again, there's no absolute consensus, but the things that are frequently mentioned are a strong state, the rule of law, secure property rights, including freedom from arbitrary and punitive taxation, common law, recognition of some form of natural or human rights, a commitment to human equality, even if only in theory, some form of secular political space, although I would put the word secular in inverted commas for now, some form of political toleration and so forth, to which I think we would importantly add the scientific method and a positive commitment to work and the value of commerce. The reason for my mention of the Statute of Monopolies was because the Statute of Monopolies was a tiny piece in this jigsaw, establishing in law for the first time a secure patent system by which inventors and investors could be confident that they would reap some reward from their activity. Now, here's the crucial thing about the Statute of Monopolies. It was passed by the English Parliament in 1623. In other words, a very long time before anyone imagines the Enlightenment began. And here is the thing about most other inclusive institutions, such as I mentioned above. They have their intellectual origins long before the Enlightenment, and many of them have existed in real, tangible forms before the Enlightenment too. The concept of the individual and of secular public space, like many other inclusive institutions, predate the Enlightenment, perhaps by centuries. What happened at the Enlightenment, and what Steven Pinker and others get so excited about, was in fact the result of what is known as the Glorious Revolution of 1688, the moment in which a seemingly inexorable slide through yet another English civil war was halted, James II evicted, and William and Mary placed on the throne. This was the moment in which an unusual number of inclusive institutions came together in a stable balance, a balance that united ideas of rights, equality, limited royal power, parliamentary sovereignty, frequent parliaments, overseen taxation, domestic peace and stability, rule of law, common law, property rights, and comparative free speech and comparative freedom of religion. In other words, the 18th century did not represent a new and unprecedented start in human history, but one in which various philosophers and politicians and investors and inventors picked up and built on the existing institutions of European order, which had been slowly crafted over the centuries. This gives the lie to the "it's all because of the Enlightenment" story, but doesn't have any bearing on our subject tonight. Just because the Enlightenment isn't necessarily the answer to the question, where do I come from? It doesn't necessarily mean that Christianity is. Now, I want to make one thing clear before I proceed to the next bit of my argument. Just as Steven Pinker is determined to trace every good thing there is to the Enlightenment, so there are some Christians who want to do the same for Christianity. I am not one of them. Pinker came back to me in our debate to say that I could hardly explain the law of patents as a specifically Christian contribution to Western civilization. And he's perfectly right. You have to distinguish between those institutions that emerged from a Christian culture and those that emerged for a Christian reason. Nevertheless, it is highly instructive that a significant number of these inclusive institutions that transformed Europe and subsequently the world have their roots not simply in a Christian culture, but in Christian reasons. Let me give a few here in what I fear is inexcusably brief detail. One, the question of political authority. The attempt to make political power answerable to the norms of justice and even to the people, the question of what comprised legitimate government and the lawfulness of rebellion, had all been fiercely contested in political theology for centuries before the Enlightenment. The answer, such as a single answer was ever established, was that power became authority in as far as it answered to the demands of justice, as set out in God's law. Intriguingly, however, the idea that the people's conception of their own good was also a legitimate element in the demands of justice was voiced from a surprisingly early stage. Many years ago, I was stunned, not too strong a word, to read a 10th century Anglo-Saxon sermon which contained the following lines: "No man can make himself king, but the people has the choice to choose a king whom they please. But after he is consecrated as king, he then has dominion over the people, and they cannot shake his yoke from their necks." That is a quite astonishing sentiment for the time. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that it took close on a millennium for it to be established within mainstream cultures. Example two, the rule of law. This was a major plank of medieval European jurisprudence, and it found its most famous articulation in the Magna Carta. But the theory behind that document derived, via Stephen Langton, who was Archbishop of Canterbury at the time, from canon lawyers' reflections on the Torah, and in particular, the book of Deuteronomy, early on in the Bible, in which, in chapter 17, it says, "When the king takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God, and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites, and turn from the law to the right or to the left." You see, the idea that all power should be under law is about as far from intuitive as you can get. And it only took root within Christendom, and only really, to be honest, within Latin Christendom, because of the dual power of the scriptures and the papacy, which sought to limit temporal power in a series of angry encounters. In the words of the political scientist Francis Fukuyama, "To understand the development of the rule of law, one must look not just to the source and nature of religious rules themselves, but also the specific ways religious authority is organized and institutionalized. The rule of law in Europe was rooted in Christianity." And Fukuyama is not an apologist for Christianity. Three, the development of secular political space. The word secular derives originally from a Latin word meaning generation or age. And it was adopted in early Christian writings to mean this age, or more precisely, confined to this present age that is passing away. secular power had authority over this realm, and it should, therefore, be respected. However, it could also be legitimately challenged if it flagrantly ignored God's law and justice. And perhaps most importantly, that earthly power could never accord to itself absolute or ultimate significance. Caesar deserved respect, but Caesar was not God. Fourth, the argument for political toleration. Now, this was made most influentially by John Locke in 1689, and it's fair to say that Locke was perhaps the quintessential early Enlightenment political theorist. However, it is telling that he made his case for religious toleration, and as it happens, his case for equality too, on explicitly biblical grounds. Reading his first letter concerning toleration and his first treatise on government is like reading an extended essay of biblical exegesis. Indeed, the professor of law and philosophy, Jeremy Waldron, who has done more than anyone else to draw attention to Locke's biblical thought, has gone as far as to say that Locke's deep justification for equality is more robust than the non-biblical reasons that have subsequently come to replace it. And that's not something that secular champions of the Enlightenment say very much about. Just four examples, each of which merits at least a monograph, but they might be multiplied. The idea of natural rights was grounded and articulated in the thinking of canon lawyers, as the scholars Brian Tierney and Harold Berman have shown. The development of civil society and what we might call corporationism is also traceable to the canonists' understanding of the corporation as a voluntary association of individuals who remain the source of its authority, as opposed to some higher body. There had been plenty of proto-scientific revolutions in the ancient and medieval world and in China, but the reason why Europe turned a scientific revolution into the scientific revolution in the 17th century can be traced in part to the doctrines of creation and wisdom, and interestingly, the fall that help shape post-Reformation Europe. Now, as I said earlier, we need to be careful not to overclaim for Christianity here. The ways in which the medieval church secured the rule of law or limits to secular power were usually thoroughly self-interested and self-serving. The investiture crisis between the Pope and the Emperor at the end of the 11th century offers a very good example of how history is rarely a question of the good guys versus the bad guys. Similarly, although a democratically accountable government had been seriously proposed by one Colonel Thomas Rainsborough in the Putney debates of 1647, in which he famously said that the poorest man in England is not bound to that government, that he hath not a voice to put himself under, it's also fair to say that ecclesiastical influence consistently weighed against democracy well into the 19th century. It's a telling fact that in the first reading of the Great Reform Act in Britain in 1832, it was almost unanimously voted against by the bishops. The bishops rarely voted en masse, but they found a common cause against democracy. A series of rioting crowds stoned episcopal palaces and overturned episcopal vehicles helped change their mind when it came to the second reading. Much the same can be said of freedom of speech and of the press, which only Christian radicals tended to campaign. History is a messy business, and it is nobody's biddable slave. Nevertheless, in spite of the many failings of Christians down the ages, and I would humbly suggest that includes many of us today, it is nonetheless the case that the building blocks of the modern world, of secularism, of the individual, of lawfulness, of representation, and so forth, were cut and crafted not only in Christian cultures, but very often according to Christian designs. To quote the wonderful Larry Seedentop, who's traced this development during the medieval period, the roots of liberalism were firmly established in the arguments of philosophers and canon lawyers by the 14th and early 15th centuries. belief in a fundamental equality of status as the proper basis for a legal system, belief that enforcing moral conduct is a contradiction in terms, a defence of individual liberty through the assertion of fundamental natural rights, and finally, the conclusion that only a representative form of government is appropriate for a society resting on the assumption of moral equality. This is certainly a more accurate and more satisfying answer than simply the Enlightenment did it. But it still invites another question. What was it about Christian thought and culture that had this effect? If tracing causality within the material connections of history is difficult, then tracing it between the history of ideas and that of institutions was positively perilous. Moreover, given the variety and complexity of those institutions and commitments, it would be daft to imagine that there was any one single comprehensive answer to that question. That noted, I would like to suggest that there is a thread that goes some way to uniting these factors, and it lies in our understanding of the value of the human. The idea at the heart of humanism, properly understood, is that the human has an incommensurable and ineradicable worth, and that worth is independent of somebody's wealth or class or status or social connections or even cognitive or physical abilities. And a bit like the rule of law, that is a very long way from being intuitive and self-evident. It certainly wasn't self-evident in the ancient world into which Christianity was born, where there was a whole class of humans who had no inherent dignity, let alone independence. They were called slaves. And it wasn't the case in the late modern world, where utilitarian calculations or social Darwinism or supposedly scientific racism proved rationally that not only were some beings worth less than others, but some were pretty much worth less. Christianity identified God, the source of all that is good and beautiful and true, with human form. More than that, it identified God with poor, homeless, peripatetic, criminal, tortured human form. And in doing so, it showed, firstly, that it had no illusions of what humans could be like, i.e. criminally violent, and secondly, that it had one big hope for what humans could be like, i.e. self-giving and loving to the extreme. It exhorted its followers to embrace the latter without ignoring the former. From this commitment to God in human form, there slowly evolved ideas of human will, dignity, equality, and what we would call rights. From the parallel theological commitment that God was trustworthy, there were generated similar commitments to the lawfulness of human society and the lawfulness of the created order and the intelligibility of the created order. There is an intellectual cogency to that argument, I think, and almost a mathematical neatness to it. Law plus gospel equals redemption. However, the history of ideas is not the history of history. And anyone halfway honest, believer or otherwise, will point out that it didn't actually pan out this way in reality. Repeat, history is messy, and no one's biddable slave. And there's a case in point, slavery. It's fair to say that the early Christians had an attitude to slavery that somewhat disappoints us today. We want them to have been proto-abolitionists in the way that William Wilberforce was many centuries later, but very few, if any, were. The story isn't quite as grim as some like to make out. Ever since Constantine had granted the church the power of manumission, Christians had emancipated slaves in significant numbers, particularly around Easter time. The church father John Chrysostom spoke of a perfect, but probably eschatological society, in which no one would rule over others, and he celebrated the legal rights, the extension of legal rights and protections to slaves, and he damned Christian masters who humiliated their slaves. Perhaps most remarkably, Gregory of Nyssa fulminated against the very institution of slavery itself and denounced Christians for daring to imagine that they could own another human being when such a right belonged to God alone. Nevertheless, it's right to say that they are pretty extreme positions. The reality, as historians like Peter Brown and more recently Karl Harper have outlined, is that the story is quite complex. Slavery in the ancient world was ineradicably linked to sex. In Peter Brown's words, what mattered in Roman law and in Roman sexual morality had little to do with sex. It had everything to do with whose bodies could be enjoyed with impunity and whose could not be touched without elaborate formulas of consent. In Kyle Harper's words, laws deflected lust away from the freeborn body and slaves provided a ready outlet. This concept of sex was anathema to early Christians, with their overwhelmingly Jewish ideas of fidelity to a single spouse and a supreme willingness to do away with the unwanted accidents of sexual procreation through abortion and infanticide. Slavery was tolerable as an institution, but what went on within it was intolerable. It wasn't just that early Christians were frightful prudes and Puritans and disliked the idea of sex, although I have to say anyone who's read a word of St. Jerome will know that there were certainly some like that. Rather, it was the fact that from St. Paul onwards, the issues of sex and freedom were closely linked. Porneia was more than a simple sexual immorality, but stood as a metonym for mankind's rebellion against God. The Christian's body was owned by God, which meant it could not be truly owned by a slave owner. One of the foundations of slavery was eroded away. And a similar tale can be spun from other New Testament texts. Slaves exist in the first century, and we don't hear the clarion call for universal manumission that we want to. But we do hear St. Paul relativize the institution by saying, the one who was a slave when called to the faith in the Lord is the Lord's freed person. Similarly, the one who was free when called is Christ's slave. And we hear him say there is no such thing as slave or free for those who are in Christ. And we hear him tell the members of the church in Corinth, if you can gain your freedom, do so. And perhaps most influentially, we see the evolution of an institution in which slaves and free rub shoulders together and eat the same bread and drink the same drink and are told not to attend to their social difference and not to think of themselves as better than each other. And we slowly build up a picture in which this institution, however widespread, however deep-rooted, however accepted, however obvious it is, cannot be squared with what we are now coming to believe about human beings. It takes longer to undo this institution than we today, enlightened moderns that we are, think that it should, and that there are too many voices that are indifferent to the cause. But undone, it is. When the sometimes heroically brutal Emperor Charlemagne wished to secure allegiance from all his people in 792, he takes an oath of allegiance from everyone, including slaves. As Seedentop rightly points out, no ancient emperor would have dreamed of doing that. It was almost literally unthinkable in antiquity. You might as well have asked for an oath from a pack horse. So we're left with one final question. If we can reasonably show that our journey towards justice, peace, and prosperity owes a little less to the Enlightenment and a little more to Christianity than we popularly imagine, does this constitute anything more than an interesting historical fact? More pertinently, does it matter if much of the West is busily soaring through its Christian roots? Now, the potential here to say something as stupid as it is apocalyptic is enormous. It would be a kind of cosmic version of the so-called Project Fear that sought and failed to keep the UK in the EU. If we leave, whether that be the EU or God, planes will fall from the sky, rivers will run with blood, mountains will crumble, and we will almost certainly have to put forward an emergency budget. No, that isn't going to happen, and pretending it will simply stokes fear in advance and derision in retrospect. Having said that, the foundations of our foundations do matter. When a utilitarian anthropology swept all before it in early 19th century Britain, Parliament passed the Anatomy Act, which made the bodies of poor of people who were too poor to pay for their own funerals available to medical schools for dissection. It was a wholly rational thing to do, according to utilitarian logic. If you wish to increase and maximise pleasure and minimise pain, it was self-evident that you could dissect dead bodies because they didn't feel pain, and that you would do some good because you would learn something of the body that would allow you to optimise pleasure. On utilitarian grounds, it made sense. It was just uncanny how it only applied to the bodies of poor people. And the same utilitarian anthropology passed a new poor law, which sought to solve all our social ills by making state welfare, anachronistically put, so unattractive that the destitute and the most desperate would seek it out. And you get Oliver Twist. Ideas do matter. When an evolutionary anthropology carried intellectuals away in the late 19th century, forced sterilisation of the stupid and, again, the poor became an obvious solution. As the Supreme Court Justice and highly regarded figure Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, three generations of imbecile are enough. Ideas do matter. When, through a combination of utilitarianism and liberalism in market interactions, one candidate for the governor of Nevada can argue that drivers should be allowed to pay $25 a day to exceed the state speed limit, or the economist Kenneth Balding can propose a system of marketable procreation licenses as a way of dealing with overpopulation, or the judge Richard Posner can advocate the use of markets to allocate babies put up for adoption, all examples collected by Professor Michael Sandel, we can see again that ideas do matter. Recently, the American academic John Evans published the findings from an extended research project he had been conducting under the title, What is a Human? Exploring what the answers mean for human rights. What's interesting about this project is that it sidestepped the standard issue here around what are sometimes called contested humans, i.e. whether the fetus or the embryo or those in a persistent vegetative state or higher primates can be considered human. Instead, it focused on the status of uncontested humans, those entities that are considered to be human by all commonly used anthropologies. Evans wasn't interested in how we treat people when we disagree about whether they are people or not. He was interested in how we treated people who we were sure were people. The answer's obvious, isn't it? We treat them like people. But that is the problem with wearing ideological glasses. You don't always notice what you're looking through. You can only see one vision of the world, and you can't imagine why anyone would see anything different. Evans was interested in the spectacles we wear. He tested four different anthropologies: Christian, philosophical, biological, and socially conferred, each of which he identified with a particular and a precise definition. And what he found was that, I quote, the more a respondent agrees with the academic biological anthropology, essentially evolutionary. The more they are keen, the more like they are also to believe that it is acceptable to buy kidneys from the poor, have people commit suicide to save money, take blood against the will of prisoners, and not risk the military to stop a genocide. Now, John Evans is clear, and I want to be, that does not mean these people are monsters. In actual fact, he is even clearer than that, observing that regular citizens have demanding lives, and they do not have the time to make sure their positions on public issues reach the level of logical coherence that a philosopher would be held to. In other words, we make yet another anthropological error if we imagine that people think through a series of metaphysical, philosophical, and ethical presuppositions and then live by them. Very, very few of us do that. However, Evans' research and Michael Sandel's examples and plenty of moments from the history of the last 200 years underline the fact that ideas do matter, and ideas about the human matter a lot. Virtually every community founded in the West for over 1,500 years had at its centre a building. And at the centre of that building was the image of a man who was to be worshipped, despite being poor, lonely, and broken. This was the beating heart of our common life, and in an attenuated way it still is. Humans being humans got it wrong and ignored or abused that image time and time again. But it remained a powerful, mute symbol, calling us back time and again, telling the story of what humans are capable of doing to one another, but also who we are capable of being for one another. I was one for whom this story was a firmly closed book for the first 20 or so years of my life, and when I was finally persuaded to open it, I did so hesitantly and reluctantly. But in retrospect, I'm glad I did, and I'm also glad I live in a culture in which was formed, however imperfectly, by that book and that image. Thank you very much indeed.